Welcome to Security Squad. This is a CertSecurity.com podcast, a year in review, part one of two. This episode was recorded on December 13th, 2010. Well, thanks for joining us. I'm Rob Westervelt. Joining me today in the studio is Eric Parizeau. Eric is senior site editor of CertSecurity.com. Hey, Eric, how are you?
Hi, Rob.
Of course, this is a look back, Eric. How would you describe 2010?
For the world of security, I don't know if it was good or bad, but gosh, it seemed like there was a lot going on this year. Just a lot of different types of attacks, a lot of interesting industry developments, a lot of things around the cloud, obviously. It'll be fun to rehash and kind of see what we think is going to happen going forward.
Yeah. Oh, also in the studio is Mike Momoso. Mike is editorial director of the Security Media Group here at TechTarget. Hey, Mike.
Good morning.
And for you, 2010?
Personally?
You happy to see it go?
Yeah, I'm happy to see it go. I always look ahead. You never look back.
Yeah.
Except for today.
You know, me too. I'm happy that 2010 is over and looking forward. I'm happy I still have a job.
I second that. I'm happy you have a job too.
I don't know how that happened, but...
We also have a special guest for this episode. Pete Lindstrom is joining us on the phone. Pete is a security expert and industry analyst. He is currently research director for Spire Security. Hey, Pete, thanks a lot for taking the time out to join us.
My pleasure, Rob. Always fun time.
Yeah. You can check out Pete's viewpoint at spiresecurity.com. Pete, is that right?
That is correct, yeah.
How often do you usually get a commentary out there?
Yeah, it's... Given that it's blog, it's more freeform, and I would say probably once every 2 weeks or so,
yeah.
I try to get something up that is sometimes snarky, sometimes more detailed risk-based analysis and the like, and it depends on what else is going on in the world and in my workload.
You happy to see 2010 go?
Well, you know, when you hit the ground running with something like Aurora, everything else sort of, I would say the first quarter of the year really kind of got consumed by the notion of the advanced persistent threat, the other types of issues, I thought were pretty interesting, but since there's no kind of, you know, mass hysteria associated with some particular threat, a little bit different from previous years and very interesting. That's why I'm excited to be on this podcast.
Well, cool. We're actually going to start right off with Google Aurora, obviously. That was back in January when this first kind of surfaced. Attackers used a Microsoft Internet Explorer zero-day flaw, targeted Google, Adobe Systems, and dozens of other firms. Mike, let's start with you. You know, what was your take on Google Aurora, and do you think that really set the stage for the rest of the year?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it had all the makings of a great story, didn't it? I mean, it had the mysterious, spooky Chinese stealing all our stuff from all our major companies. You had the political story behind it, you know, they were supposedly after Gmails of Chinese dissidents. A lot of different elements that made it a sexy story as far as the media goes. The vendors all jumped on the APT part of it that, you know, it's... You talk to the experts, they'll tell you it's not really anything new. It's basically targeted attacks using, you know, a combination of existing exploits and zero days. And, you know, there are a ton of angles, and it was an interesting story. And if it did nothing else, it raised the level of awareness around targeted attacks and, you know, how much information is being stolen by both sides, really. I mean, we're not innocent. If it is the Chinese government or some kind of state-sponsored attack behind it, you know, we're just as guilty of doing the same thing in reverse. So, but yeah, definitely, I think set the stage for the year, no doubt.
Pete, any lessons learned from Google Aurora?
Sure, a couple of different things. First of all, I'm not completely comfortable taking sides, but it feels like in the InfoSec world now, we have to start thinking about taking sides from either a nation state or even a cultural perspective. You know, in the days of old, InfoSec was InfoSec, and we all, you know, we had white hats versus black hats, and now you don't know what color the hat is of the person that is talking to you or sitting next to you at security conferences, for that matter. So it's a challenge trying to apply what we've known in the past from an information security perspective to the nuances associated with human interaction at this sort of macro global level. That worries me actually quite a bit, trying to figure out how much we need to temper the information distribution and our general personal feelings towards folks. So Aurora hits the ground running in early January. We find out about this advanced persistent threat, which it's easy to sort of smirk at, and some folks are adamant that it's something new and important, and in some respects it is, but from a technical perspective, certainly all of the types of attacks that were used we've seen before. So trying to decide whether APT means anything from an operational perspective, I think you end up on the negative side. That is, it shouldn't change what you're doing unless you weren't doing the right thing to begin with.
I think there was a lot of hype this year because of Aurora surrounding the concept of APT. What are the origins? What are the motives of these kinds of attacks? Who is involved? Is it the Chinese government? What do they want? Is this what APT is going to look like going forward? Clearly, this to me was the first big salvo in this new era of targeted attacks. And these are going to be with us for quite some time. And when you combine these attacks with 0 days that obviously nobody has seen before, it increases the damage that can be done right off the bat. So to me, the lessons are that there's going to be more of these. So our audience needs to make sure that they're putting the layered defenses in place to thwart whatever the next targeted attack is. And that's, you know, making sure users don't have elevated privileges. Get off Internet Explorer if you can. Do some basic outbound monitoring. As Pete kind of alluded to, it was really the deep analysis of the DNS logs that enabled Google to figure out what was going on in the first place. I don't know if organizations can put that kind of manpower behind that kind of analysis that Google put forth, but you've got to be prepared for something along those lines if you find something amiss. And even think about, you know, general network segmentation as a best practice, too. If an attacker gets into one part of your network, it shouldn't necessarily mean that they should be in all of it. So, there's not going to be one silver bullet that's going to, you know, kill the APT threat. But I think looking at the silver lining of Aurora here, hopefully organizations will understand that these kinds of attacks are only going to get more and more sophisticated and more targeted. So every organization is going to have to be prepared to defend itself.
You know, one of the major responses right after this whole thing came out, one of the lines of thinking were, okay, we need to ditch Internet Explorer and use an alternative browser. And there was actually a couple of countries that mandated that. I think Germany, possibly Australia, I don't remember. But there were a few countries that, at least within the government, they got off of Internet Explorer. What do you think of that kind of response? Mike, why don't you...
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it's a, you know, kind of a token response. Hey, we did something in that respect. I mean, one thing that bugs me about this whole APT conversation from the beginning was that this is basically espionage. It's espionage on a you know, a new platform over the internet, whatever. And that whole notion of this cyber war and cyber espionage being kind of interchanged pretty freely, it bugs me a little bit. And I don't know, Pete, do you think I'm just being nitpicky, or does it change the way, you know, especially corporations have to approach this problem?
I'm not sure I'm following you.
Well, I mean, it's espionage, right? It's not. It's corporate espionage. You're stealing intellectual property. You're poking around in you know, defense department and defense contractors, big enterprises, trying to steal, you know, blueprints, intellectual property, and at the same time, people are calling all that activity cyber war. I mean, does it matter? Do we need that distinction, or am I just overreacting?
Well, I certainly kind of cringe at the notion of a cyber war as well. Part of me says, okay, you know, there's a lot less blood flowing online than there is in the real world. Being a former Marine, I part of me relishes the notion of cyber war, but there's so many contradictions associated with the concept online. Do you want to keep the lines of communication open or closed? Is this DDoS kinds of stuff? But the espionage thing is, it's more cultural than it is nation state kind of thing, and that's what worries me even more. Is this idea of stealing trade secrets and the ease of duplication of various things, the black market associated with our information assets. It's very tricky stuff, and I tend to agree with you that we're better off thinking of it from an espionage standpoint as opposed to some form of war, because war, connotes a notion of battles and blood and victory and lines being drawn, and I just don't think you can do that online. It's a much more subtle kind of activity, as brutish as it can be.
APT, most overhyped word of 2010? Term of 2010?
I think that works for me.
Yeah, I agree.
It's been used in the past, obviously, and
apparently has a military origin, I don't know. But,
oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly if you're out on Tau security checking in with Richard Baitlick, a security monitoring expert, you'd know that it's been brought up in the past, but really has only come to some sort of general discussion and understanding of it, or general recognition, I guess, this year. And even still, I mean, we probably spent 6 months fighting over the definition as if we can drive what millions of folks how millions of folks are going to define a term. And it can get, I would say that there was a lot of semantic issues, that's semantic, not Symantec, clouding the judgment of the people with the feet on the street, because we didn't come up with any real operational readiness kinds of, okay, what do I do in response to it, right? I'm reminded of the years gone by. It was years ago when a security pundit at, I think it was at either Black Hat or DEF CON, said we don't know whether an attack is a hack or an attack unless we know what's in the hearts and minds of the attacker or the hacker. And I'm just like, oh, you know, do we have a heart and mind filter on our IDSs these days? You know, it's so tricky to really get to the notion of it. You have to be objective, and what you see is what you see. It's bits on the wire and on your systems. You have to be able to know if there's anything you need to do differently to address those bits on the wire.
And with that, I think we'll move to Stuxnet. The in terms of Stuxnet, it surfaced around July time period. This thing was unique in that it identified Siemens supervisory control and data acquisition software. We know that the code was extremely sophisticated. It was the first worm to target four Microsoft zero-day vulnerabilities that it injected itself into programmable logic controllers. These are the controls in an industrial operation that monitor the most critical parts of an industrial operation, from pressure, temperature, and other critical processes. This also strikes me as being a little overhyped, but Mike, were you surprised when you first heard about Stuxnet, the fact that this kind of worm was out there and targeting this specific...
Not surprised that it exists, but apparently the complexity of it was pretty unique and pretty sophisticated, and there were a lot of different components to Stuxnet, and the fact it was targeting these control systems and a very particular component of these control systems, I think merits a lot of attention, you know, as much or more than an Aurora kind of attack.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we heard a ton about cyber war when Stuxnet surfaced.
Yeah, it's a little closer, isn't it?
Yeah. The experts I talked to said, you know, they think that this was developed by a very well-funded organization of cyber criminals, or well-funded organization, period. a group likely with a software development team in place. So the code was that sophisticated. I think it took reverse engineers months to decompile the code and, mm-hmm. And test it and find out that all of these zero-day vulnerabilities that it targeted, all the different specific.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently, pieces of this thing were showing up, 12 to 18 months ago?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I pictured George W. Bush and his former cabinet in a room hacking away on a computer to create this thing. I mean, this is the weird thing about Stuxnet, right? Especially if you try to contrast it with Aurora and you go, okay, well, you know, it appears that at least some of the primary targets were in Iran, and does that mean, once again, that there is nation-state involvement, but perhaps on the side that many of us take, and therefore is this sort of benevolent malware from our perspective or not? And you're right, the fact that this stuff, 500 megabytes worth of code or whatever it was, and the trickle-down notion of the new information we're still receiving about Stuxnet are certainly high on the list of things that make you go, hmm. Mm-hmm.
The experts I spoke with all said that the code could be, parts of the code could be copied for future malware, pieces of malware.
Yeah, I mean, you wrote a good story about this, how it's kind of could be a blueprint for future types of this kind of malware. So right.
We've already seen, I think, one example of that, at least. It's kind of superficial. I mean, piece of malware using the same zero-day vulnerability, mm-hmm. or using a zero-day vulnerability. So.
Well, and this is, you know, Aurora and Stuxnet are great examples where we're leveraging this notion of zero-day vulnerability, and the tricky thing here is that the term zero-day is somewhat ambiguous, but to the extent that we're finding this stuff through attacks in the wild, it's clearly much more serious than what goes on in the general research community and the kind of dog and pony associated with good guys finding vulnerabilities and increasing our risk while they're at it. Meanwhile, we really need to focus on zero-day attacks where we're identifying stuff in the wild, things like Stuxnet and Aurora. And remember, hey, WMF was really only a couple years ago, and that really, I think, started this latest trend of vulnerabilities that we don't know about being attacked that we still need to defend against. We often forget that next month there will be a Microsoft Tuesday, among many other vulnerability releases, and we currently don't know much about what the vulnerabilities are and perhaps don't have solid enough protection in place to protect our enterprises or other organizations from these types of things.
Mm-hmm. And this month alone, I think 17 bulletins, 40,
yeah.
Patching 40 vulnerabilities in Microsoft products.
I mean, the good news of these types of things, Aurora and Stuxnet, is that we can be successful. Even if we don't know about the vulnerability in advance, these are success stories. You know, we, in particular, Stuxnet, Aurora, certainly folks could argue, wait a minute, Aurora actually got on the systems of these 20-some-odd companies. But we need to work a lot harder in that regard to be trying to define behavior appropriately and look for anomalous activity and do all that sort of stuff that's been buzzed about in the InfoSec world for years now. I think that level of focus is my lesson from 2010, is to, you know, really start thinking about how your monitoring game and your forensics game is going to be strengthened over the next few years. Otherwise, it could be big trouble for you, your organization.
A couple things from me. It seems like in general, 2010 was a year of wake-up calls for a lot of different reasons. And this one certainly was a wake-up call for information security managers for critical infrastructure facilities. And as has been reported, 85% of those facilities are privately owned. So it's not as if the government can say, well, we're going to beef up our critical infrastructure security. You know, they can wave the flag. They can, you know, sound the alarm. They can make recommendations. And to a certain extent, they can even throw money at the problem if they want to. But it's really up to the infrastructure managers, the facilities, the companies themselves, to kind of figure out what the problems are and realize that they need to take action to update them. And Pete touches on a pet peeve of mine, which is I think it's great for the industry as a whole to constantly try to update its methods for identifying these kinds of potential attacks proactively, but there are always going to be these kinds of attacks. They're never going to go away. So to me, saying, okay, let's do a better job of you know, figuring them out in advance is kind of a lost cause. To me, the message is, again, going back to the layered defense theme, you've got to kind of learn from the lessons that we've had so far. And as, you know, for our listeners, for the enterprises out there, figure out the technologies and the processes that are going to need to be put in place to prevent from being victimized in a similar way. Mm-hmm. And I think this particular incident put a lot of emphasis on the need to update software. And we're not talking about just Microsoft software. Obviously, Windows, Internet Explorer, all that needs to be updated.
Yeah, these are zero days. I mean, you can't really update a, you know, what can you do?
But you're talking, you know, if you're a critical infrastructure facility and you're using version 2.0 of the power management program, and, you know, there's version 5.0 out there.
Or if you're Google and you're using IE6, right?
Yeah, that's another issue. Well,
instead of Chrome, I don't know why they weren't using Chrome.
Think about that. Why it's no coincidence that Google's looking to migrate off of Microsoft infrastructure entirely at this point. Yeah.
Well, you
learn their lesson.
But you have to keep in mind the challenge associated with upgrading software on systems that are very temperamental to begin with, or very significant. Right. It's not uncommon to essentially firewall off any kind of network systems that are running, you know, very old operating systems, and it's a challenge to try to decide when and how to upgrade. These aren't client PCs where we can set auto update on. These things are running manufacturing plants and, you know, MRI systems, healthcare systems, and our critical infrastructure, our electricity backplanes, and we need to, you know. So certainly we have to be very careful about touching any of that stuff. And so the I think a real true economic analysis and risk assessment is required to really understand how important and significant these attacks are, and make judgment calls about how significant they're likely to be. But, you know, Eric, I think, has a good point on the layered defense. Since you have the network layer and the potential opportunity to remove some of these more sensitive networks from the internet overall, although I cringe at that thought, to be honest, there is at least the notion of protection from outside of the systems.
I think it's important for organizations to realize they can no longer not think about the need to, you know, update the software for these critical systems. You know, I think my assumption, I don't know for sure, but, you know, if you're a hospital, maybe you don't think about updating your MRI machine outside of every 5 years or so. You know, you probably have to think about that more often now. And I think that's the sort of lesson that needs to be learned here, is that those risk assessments need to take place. There needs to be more strategic management of updates from a security perspective.
Yeah, maybe.
I mentioned that I posted recently on the TSA scanner fiasco over Thanksgiving.
Yep, I opted out.
Yeah, there was, and like I said, ancillarily related, but in doing my research, it turns out that the TSA does a lot of risk analysis in making some of their decisions. I didn't find one for the scanners, but I did find two, one for secure flight and one for the large aircraft security program, that were other initiatives that they've run. that were, I would consider, fairly scientific. And at the very least, when you do these analyses and kind of put out these numbers that we all know are estimates and have ranges associated with them and stuff, people can talk about whether we're in the right ballpark, right? The orders of magnitude associated with the types of risk we're talking about. It's very difficult to say, the risk is high for blankety-blank, another Aurora kind of attack, when people interpret the word high to mean anything from, you know, probably 75% risk to 95% risk, and very often we actually mean 20% risk.
Well, this next issue actually goes along with our discussion on Stuxnet, because I'm going to skip to the CSIS report, which came out also in January, almost around the same time period as the Google Aurora incident. And that's this survey that CSIS did. It was funded partially by McAfee, but it was a survey of more than 600 IT and security executives who work at companies that run chemical facilities and other critical infrastructure industrial control facilities. And it came out with some, I think, kind of set the stage for what we saw with Stuxnet later in the year. And basically, two-thirds of those surveyed, 76%, said their SCADA systems were connected to an IP network or the Internet. And this is a global survey. About half of those said the connection created SCADA system security issues. And then towards the end of that study, they asked whether these people expected a major incident in their facility. 40% of those surveyed expected a major incident, an attack resulting in major consequences within a year. And another 80% said they expected a major incident within 5 years.
Yeah, unfortunately, the security industry is primarily reactive. I mean, it's hard to be proactive when you're putting out fires every day, little fires, big fires. Yeah. But you're right. The awareness counts for something, and maybe that there will be some movement, as Eric says, and thinking about upgrading software where possible. But these are critical systems, and downtime and availability is critical. You can't have downtime. These systems have to be up, and if you're patching or replacing software, you certainly don't want to be responsible for any power outages or disruption of service on any level. Unfortunately, it may take some kind of disaster or, either on a big scale or a smaller scale for some real movement to happen, unfortunately, because that's just the nature of this industry.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a great point and a great issue to think about with respect to this quantitative discussion we had earlier. So 40% say they had they were expecting an attack within a year. We're at the end of the year. I'm pretty sure 40% of SCADA-oriented companies did not have some sort of severe catastrophic attack, although I guess presumably we could suggest that it was kept under the covers, but I would suspect that if it's critical infrastructure and it's catastrophic, we would know about it. And so we can start discussing why we're so concerned about that from that level of perspective. And the challenge here is we're not discounting the threat, right? We're not discounting the risk. We're suggesting that we should open the discussion up to the industry around what is the likelihood of these kinds of attacks and how do we make that likelihood get lower and lower from a security perspective. Even I was just reading recently, remember the Brazil power plant that went out, turns out the WikiLeaks stuff was good for something, I suppose, and that was a longer discussion along the lines that the power plant, some of us might have suspected that there was some sort of cyber attack associated with that going out, and it appears that that's fairly unlikely, at least according to some of the folks who were in the know at the time.
Yeah. Were there any, did you actually take a look at this report Pete, I mean, did you think that this was anything revealing, or is this something that...
Rob, why look at a report when I can read your excellent article on that report?
Well, I just wonder if this is like the same old that you get. You would get surveying any security pro,
yeah,
right? They're going to be over.
This is a challenge for having been around the block. A lot of this is same old, and you start going, where's the beef? Now, certainly raising the awareness on the critical infrastructure side is useful, but like I said, it also, in my mind, points out a glaring problem, which is how do we get real about this stuff? How do we? I don't want to overestimate the risk, so folks call us chicken littles when the risk still exists. Right? There are significant challenges here, especially when you consider the consequences associated with an attack against our SCADA systems. This is the most serious stuff we have, right? And I want people to be real about it. I want them to be scientific about it. I want them to look at the evidence around past attacks. I want them to look at the community as a whole and some of the things we see, like Stuxnet and like Aurora, and really come to some conclusions about the nature of risk in their environments, and hopefully use that as a way to strengthen their programs and get serious about understanding this this type of risk and uncertainty with their SCADA system.
Well, that does it for this edition of Security Squad. Be sure to check out our previous podcasts by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page by going to searchsecurity.com/news. For Mike Mimoso, Eric Parizeau, and Pete Lindstrom, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.